You've tuned in to 96.7 on your FM dial. This is Hugh Cruzell, and the program is QOL, Quality of Life. Huh, you know, it's 2024, and, you know, technology is something that's, well, it's everywhere. It's always been everywhere, from the wheel to the circuit, the integrated circuit, to the visuals we have today, to the fact that we're doing this on Zoom. You know, technology really, it can improve our life. Perhaps it can imperil our lives as well. I'm talking to Dr. Rob Graham, and Rob is he's a specialist in techno-resiliency, but I know that he's got many other things that we can talk about today that will perhaps intrigue you and, you know, perhaps maybe open your eyes to some other possibilities. Welcome, Dr. Rob Graham.
I hope even more importantly, I hope will inspire you. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm really, really looking forward to our time together here today, Hugh.
And you're not just, isn't that funny? Having authored a book, there is a certain degree of, additional credibility to you as well.
Well, I don't know about that, but actually, the book that you're referring to, The Mandate to Be Great, that's actually the second book. The first book I wrote, Hugh, was basically called Techno-Resiliency in Education. And that book actually was published through Springer Publishing in the Netherlands. But, you know, it's interesting because you and I have had a chance to communicate and talk a few times, and you were out to one of the events with the Northern Ontario Angels. And the concept of techno-resiliency that I developed, it sounds very technical, and people, I think, sometimes say, oh, you know, Rob, I don't know. It sounds very PhD-ish, but the whole concept of techno-resiliency is really not about technology at all. It's really about people. And I know, Hugh, kind of what you do on this show is we talk about quality of life. And I think the whole concept of techno-resiliency, as we kind of dig into it a bit, will really resonate with your audience. So I'm really excited to kind of share kind of the backstage pass to what is techno-resiliency.
Well, that's, let's do a definition of it then, because it maybe that's what we need to do to establish a common ground so we're saying the same words.
Yeah, so techno-resiliency, and I'll give you kind of the old-fashioned Cole's Notes version. Really, techno-resiliency, in my definition, is how do we do more with less in a world and in a time when we're asked to do so much more? So that really is at the root of what is techno-resiliency. Now, I want to tell you a really interesting story. When I developed the concept of techno-resiliency, I was a PhD student at Lancaster University in England, and I had already gone over to England with a concept in mind of my research and what I wanted to do. And I was a graduate student many, many years ago at Laurentian University in the Child and Development Program. And I was exposed to a researcher named Norman Garmacy. And his research literally has rocked my world and continues to. And I used his research to kind of build my techno-resiliency on. Norman Garmacy, what he wanted to do, Hugh, is his whole mindset and research was he wanted to go in and find kids that came from really, really impoverished backgrounds. They didn't have anything. They were able to conquer and overcome the challenges they were faced with early in life and go on to be highly successful business people and leaders. And so Garmacy, what he said is, he said, man, if we could go in and kind of isolate, what are kind of the traits and what are the coping mechanisms that these kids are using to overcome versus be overcome by the challenges they're facing, then we could go in and we could train social workers, we could train, you know, teachers, and we could help other kids learn these strategies. Now, you might say, well, what the heck does that have to do with techno-resiliency? Well, I was so impressed by that research and I was so moved by it that I stood it on its head and I turned it upside down. And I said, hey, and this was all before COVID, pre-COVID. I said, what if we could identify organizations, Hugh, that don't have a lot of money, they don't have a lot of training, but they're somehow making really insightful and good use of technology. And if we could go in and take a look at these organizations where, let's face it, finances for a lot of organizations and people is a
tight barrier, very tight,
right?
Yeah.
But if we could somehow go in kind of like Garmacy on a different level and study these types of organizations and see how and why they're overcoming the challenges they face, then I can train other organizations and leaders to overcome. Now, the focus being on technology, but I have since widened the scope, and I use my research on resiliency and techno resiliency even a little broader than that. So I guess to answer your question then, how do we do more with less? How do we overcome versus be overcome by the challenges we're faced with daily, not just as organizations, but as people and individuals? So I guess that's a little bit of the backstory on how I came up with the concept.
Yeah, well, you know, originally when you said about more with less, and I attended your, well, just even your opening statements, I had the sense too that we've got a, I don't know the right word for it. We're fickle, I guess. When it comes to technology, we absorb and then abandon too many technologies so quickly. And, you know, we really don't, I think about, say, word processing. We've had to learn, unlearn, relearn, and then we can continue to pick up the newest thing, the latest thing, without really understanding the intricacies of perhaps of the tools that are available to us. We just abandon them and move on. Maybe that's just our nature.
Well, Hugh, interestingly enough, I have an insight on that, and I love the term techno-lust. Mm. And techno-lust is a concept. I kind of used it and borrowed it from another researcher I saw in a paper I had read. And one of the things I discovered, Hugh, when I went into some of the educational organizations that I studied that were making what I called techno-resilient use of technology, oftentimes they were using outdated technologies. Ah. They didn't have a lot of money. They didn't have a big technology budget. But when I conducted my interviews and I observed what was taking place, oftentimes they would say, well, you know, Rob, even though this is an outdated technology, it still has the ability to connect. It still has the ability to inspire and heighten the learning. And I found that really, really an important observation for techno-resilient organizations. I think sometimes organizations make ill-conceived purchases. They don't spend enough time looking to see if the technology that they're looking to purchase really has the ability to heighten the work performance and really it has the ability to have a positive impact on the work culture. So when I do kind of what I call techno resiliency audits, where I will go in and interview people in organizations to find out, you know, is the technology you're currently using, is it working for you? Is it helping or hindering your performance? And sometimes, you know, what we'll find is that we really don't need to upgrade the technology unless there's security issues. So, you know, beware of techno lust at a personal level and at an organizational level, and make better informed decisions. Now, one agency I worked with, it was an educational agency, I had suggested to the principal, he wanted to invest in about a $5,000 technology. I said, why don't we call up the vendor and say, look, we want to test your technology for a period of 1 month at no cost. And then what we're going to do is we are going to do what we call some action research and determine if this technology indeed has the power to do what you claim it does. And if it does, then we'll purchase it. So a lot of times vendors have what I call bells and whistles kind of, you know, sales pitches. There's really no pedagogy behind it. There's really no like, well, how does this, in the case of a student, heighten the learning or connect the teacher to the student? Or in the case of an organization, does it actually have the ability to make the performance and the job easier? So after the period of this action research, I would meet with teachers and get their insights. I would meet with the administrator, and then I filed a report. And we found after the period of 1 month that, yes, this technology was indeed worth investing in. And I would encourage people and organizations to take more of that kind of less bells and whistles and really look at the pedagogy behind a technology, because we may not really need it.
Well, test driving is a great idea. I just want to mention something that happened to me years ago. I worked for an organization and was handed a what we used to call what's the proper word for it now? We used to wear them on our belts, and it would just, show up that a call had come in, and then you dialed up that number. What were they called?
A Palm Pilot?
No,
Palm
Pilots, long
before. I remember the, when those came out.
Long before that. Gosh, a technology that very few people, I think, today have. It was so straightforward. It just showed who dialed, and you went to a phone. It could be even a payphone
it's
back
like a
then.
Messenger.
Yeah,
like a
yeah,
messenger.
A messaging
yeah,
service.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but they had
exactly.
a special name. Yeah. And Rob, I remember whoever I was working for at the time said, you know, every one of these we can have all one of these, and it cost us $3 a month, as opposed to a cell phone, which was very expensive at that time. And so, you know, it does beg the question, should we test drive? Should we figure out, should we abandon some of the technology that we have and maybe go back to some more rooted technology?
Well, you know, Hugh, when I used to teach in the Faculty of Education and I was kind of developing my techno-resiliency concept back then and working with university students on how they could connect with students through technology in the education system, you know, I'd always used to talk about techno-lust. And I used to do Dr. Rob's techno-resilient moment, and I would go...
Is that your chalk? Is that your talk tool?
Yeah, well, listen, what I used to do, Hugh, is I used to go around to like rebuilt resources, and I used to go to places, and I used to pick up outdated pieces of technology.
Ah.
And I would basically try to find ways in my little kind of office here about how I could use these $5, $10 pieces of technology to connect with students. And so one of the really interesting things during my techno-resiliency moments is I was trying to inspire and show these teachers that were going out and were going to face a very jagged and rocky landscape in education. Some schools have it all. Some schools have nothing. Mm. Some schools don't even really want technology. Really, it's all dependent on the leadership team and the culture of the school board. And I used to kind of compare it to like going up the Rocky Mountains. You might be in a school that has everything and you might be in a school that has nothing. So equipping them with a techno-resiliency kind of mindset that teaches them how to overcome and not be overcome by these challenges was really, really cool. So the one piece of technology I picked up for $3 was a, you know, the soundscape things that when people can't sleep, you have
yes.
like the thunderstorm and
yes.
you have the rain. Now, there's an outdated, there's an old kind of technology, but I would bring things like that in and show them how, you know, they could literally use that for doing read alouds with kids and how they would have those sounds. And then kids could literally take this little device, this $5 thing, and they could use those sounds as inspiration behind, you know, doing reading. And so that was the type of stuff that I did. And again, trying to demonstrate that sometimes it's not always about the latest and greatest. It's about the desire to inspire and the desire to connect at whatever level.
And I just remembered what those tools are called that I was trying to refer to. Pagers.
Pagers,
pagers.
That's right. Yeah, pagers.
But we just,
yeah,
see, yeah. And that was not that many years ago, and we've completely forgotten.
No.
I mean, we can't abandon this part of our conversation. Many schools, particularly now Quebec as a province, have said no cell phones in the classroom.
You know, it's interesting because if you think, Hugh, you think about the cell phone, this always kind of blows my mind. A single solitary cell phone has more technology in it than the entire NASA Space Center had when they actually sent somebody to the moon. And it's kind of discouraging to me that we really, as an educational institution, have not really been able to adequately harness the power of the technology, I would argue. Educators have really struggled with how to integrate technology. You know, we live in a world where you don't need to know it all.
But you need to know how to access it, Rob. How to ask the right question. You know, I'm maybe wrong, but it's either today or soon. It's Martin Luther King Day. And if I was teaching as I was years ago, I would say to my students, well, you know, let's talk about social justice. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about, you know, protests and the movement for equal rights. And I'd say, let's talk about Martin Luther King. And if I had had cell phones in my classroom, I would have said, hey, somebody tell me when Martin Luther King was born. Tell me about when, you know, let's do a you know, quick snap thing on Martin Luther King. And they'd walk out of there and go, wow, we just used our phones to do something amazing.
But here, Hugh, in that is what I have identified in my book, Mandate to Be Great, which I think is an important issue. It's not so much today. We don't need the encyclopedias. You know, the encyclopedias, I remember when mom and dad bought a set of encyclopedias and the encyclopedia salesman came and they were all over the shag carpet. And I couldn't believe my parents bought the encyclopedia. So, you know, we had the encyclopedias. Today we have access to more information, than ever. So really what it is, it's about cultivating a sense of what I call nethics, right? Nethical behavior. Nethical behavior. So teaching kids how to be able to discern what is credible, what is real, and what is not real. Right. So, you know, whenever a teacher says to just Google it, I cringe. Because by telling a kid to just Google it, we haven't really adequately taught them about literally how to know what's credible, what's reliable. Now, Hugh, let's talk about the elephant in the room. I read something this morning that they're saying up to 40% of jobs are going to be lost because of AI. Now, I don't know whether that's true, whether, yeah, but here's what AI means to me. For what I do, I offer inspiration as innovation. And at the heart of everything I do is the interpersonal experience. It's not really about technology. AI, I believe what's going to happen in the future is people are going to be craving credibility, interpersonal relationships and information more than ever. I think we're going to find today, and I think organizations more than ever today are looking for people that are real, people they can trust. Because with AI, we don't know what's real. We don't know, you know, we don't know what's reliable. We don't know where information's coming from. And I think it's really important today, you know, that I think this opportunity, I said this to my 22-year-old, you know, she has great work ethic. She has incredible interpersonal skills. And I said, Shay, I think today more than ever, those types of things are going to be desirable and they're going to be craved because we're living in a world now where we don't know what's real. We don't know what's credible. So teaching kids ethical behavior, how to discern what's real and not real in an unreal world. Now, I'm not going to go into, I've actually developed a process for working with kids and helping people, you know, discern that. But that's kind of my take on AI.
That's you know what? You talk about mind blowing. I mind blew up just right there when you said, you know, about the future of work, the future of how we decide what's right and what's wrong, and all these implications for quality of life. I mean, if you make the wrong decision, do you pine for the right decision? If you made the wrong decision in careers, do you then regret for the rest of your life? What if you've spouted something that you've heard, read, come across, watched on the internet, and, you know, now your credibility is called into question?
Yeah, we live in a world, I think, you know, it's only going to continue to be biggie-sized. You know, offering inspiration as innovation is kind of at the backstage of what I do. But, you know, I think people that are, if we talk about it from an organizational standpoint, because you mentioned that, you know, we need to create not self-determined workers, but determined workers. And I think today creating emotionally and psychologically responsive workplaces has never been a greater challenge for employers, but I think it's also really, really important to create that connectedness in what some argue is kind of a disconnected world. Now, I want to tell you a quick story because years ago, I did a podcast called Teaching Screenagers.
And I love that you turn these words into, you know, that's marvelous. Screenagers.
Yeah, well, so interestingly enough, when you talk to kids today and you know, parents, you know, we're often saying, you know, you're so disconnected. And there was a research paper that I had read that kind of quoted that if you talk to your average teenager today, they will argue, Hugh, that they are more connected to their friends than you and I have ever been. But really, it boils down to the nature of what it means to be connected.
Yes.
Right. So I think today technology's challenged And I don't know that we in our generation, Hugh, have readily accepted maybe the nature of connection is different. You know, for us, I view connection as that interpersonal face-to-face.
Yes.
Teenagers argue that they are connected 24/7.
With anyone in the world.
That's right. So it comes down to, in my humble opinion, you know, the nature of what it means to be connected today. And I think there's a bit of a gap there, a generational gap.
Well, I want to get out my quill and some ink and maybe make some papyrus paper and lick a stamp and put it on an envelope. I mean, that's not connected anymore. I mean, it's still beautiful to do that. And calligraphy is an amazing art. But let's face it, doing what we're doing today is very deeply enhancing of the question of connectedness and quality of life.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, and again, let's bring up, you know, in a post-COVID world, you know, when we went Hugh, from, you know, kind of the, well, let me share this story. I had the opportunity to visit the Google workplace in Boston. There, you know, the legendary Google, and they spent millions and millions of dollars creating spaces where people never had to leave and potentially never wanted to leave. And, you know, it just blew my mind to see, you know, the offices that had arcade rooms and they had music rooms and they had sleep chambers and they had baristas there. And you know, you literally didn't have
was it
to
heaven?
Ever leave.
Was it heaven?
It was unbelievable. But in a post-COVID world, right, we look at Facebook and we look at all these organizations that invested in these places where the term I use in my book is where you could have spontaneous collaboration.
Yes.
Is a term I came up with. So that, you know, their whole thinking behind it, I think, Hugh, was that they wanted spaces where people had the freedom to collaborate around not just the cooler that in your normal environment, but you could go and collaborate in the music room. You could go and sit and have a coffee or an espresso. And through those kind of collaborations and cross-pollination, you know, good things could happen. So they spent millions and millions of dollars of creating these spaces. And then we had a displaced workplace where people were working from home. And actually, Mark Zuckerberg, after COVID or slightly after, was starting to pay people a different premium from working at home versus coming to the office, because these technology firms realized they just couldn't get the same level of inspiration and they couldn't get the same level of innovation by having the displaced workplace. And so again, that's another really deep conversation about, you know, working from home versus, you know, the office. And so, you know, we could spend hours talking about that.
Definitely.
And I have a chapter.
You've opened the door to a, well, something that I've got to ask, because, and this is not necessarily the appropriate time to do it, because we're not really at the end, the real end of this podcast. But if somebody wanted, they're listening out there in radio land and they go, my God, this Dr. Graham, he's speaking the language I want. I need to know more. How do people reach you, Rob?
Well, what's really interesting, Hugh, is even though I'm regarded as a bit of a pioneer and a guru in technology, I have kind of balked a little bit about getting myself out there as much as I possibly could or should virtually. But having said that, Hugh, I have a wonderful website, and you literally just have to go to mandatetobegreat.com, www.mandatetobegreat.com, and you can go there and connect with me. I have a place there that, you know, if you want to have an inspirational kind of Zoom session to know more about how I can help, that's a great starting point, Hugh, I would welcome the opportunity to work with people both at an individual level.
And that could be a CEO, it could be an athlete, it could be, I think anybody could, grabbing either of your books, desire for greatness, desire to exceed, to excel, to perhaps even, you know, maybe just imagine the possibilities. It would be great to connect with you. I know that we did through LinkedIn.
Yes, 100% LinkedIn as well. And I'm glad you brought that up, Hugh, because I've been able to extend some of my work. I work with different athletes and I developed kind of like a sports life skill program that uses my work in resiliency and my years in coaching. And so I mentor lots of different athletes virtually through this sports life skills program, which is an amalgam of kind of my background in teaching and learning, being an athlete, and in my research in resiliency. And I'm just having a great time and getting some great feedback from some of these athletes. You
I'm
know,
gonna I'm
it's
gonna
all.
I'm gonna actually, prompt you to maybe think about this too. Have you ever worked with politicians?
Well,
Well,
you
that's
know
maybe for
what?
the future.
The integrity and credibility piece, I think that'll be an important starting point for working on. Yeah.
Oh.
But look, Hugh, I just really do have a deep desire to inspire, and I get a tremendous amount of inspiration back from connecting with people like yourself and being on podcasts like this. We live in a world, Hugh, where people are looking for hope, and there's a lot of organizations and there's a lot of people today that are still emotionally and psychologically and financially shaken by the COVID and all of the stuff going on in our world. So, how do we find quality of life versus quantity of life, I say?
Ah.
And I think today, people are grasping for quality of life, and some people are ready to put the quantity of life on the shelf in quest for that. So, I'm a bit of a wordsmith, and I like to try to connect with people through imagery and metaphors and stuff like that, as you can already see.
If we go to your website, will it give the audience out there a chance to know where you're going to be speaking next, what your next venue is?
Well, it's interesting because my website is currently in the process. It's getting an enema, Hugh.
Oh,
My 2024 resolution, I had a 4-hour meeting yesterday with some of the people I deal with on the website. So it's going to be upgraded because I've extended some of my work in connecting with athletes now. And so the website doesn't necessarily show
reflect that.
some of the brand realignment that's gone
Right.
on.
So
So
you need some new
that's gonna,
buttons.
yeah.
You
You
need
need
some
some
new
new
buttons.
buttons. Going to reduce the information a bit and hopefully make it digestible for people. But the mandate to be great in itself is really kind of a mandate to be great in life, in business and in sport. And I love what I do. I hope people will feel my passion. I used to apologize for being so passionate. I won't apologize for it anymore because, Hugh, in this world, man, I remember Oprah Winfrey saying, passion sells and will always sell. And we need more people with passion. And so I'll never apologize for taking a
No.
passionate approach to everything I do.
Well,
You should see me play. You should see me play drums, Hugh, if you want to see passion.
well, someday I will. I want to thank Dr. Rob Graham for being my guest today, joining us, not just my guest, your guest here on QOL. Rob, thank you so much for engaging with us on a topic that perhaps is a bit of like a diving board, a springboard into so many other things. I really
It's a
appreciate it.
starting point. It's a starting point, Hugh, and maybe it deserves some follow-up conversation at some point. But thank you so very much for having me as a part of
I think
your
you're going to
show.
be a regular contributor here.
Put me on the circuit, Hugh.
I will, I will. Thank you, Dr. Rob Graham, here on QOL. Bye for now, folks.